This is DrAlvin.com, the business of wisdom, where world leaders and thinkers do come to chat. Have the extraordinary best-selling author, Ellen Cassidy. The name of the book is entitled We Are Here. How are you doing, Ellen?
Good.
Appreciate you being a part of the day's broadcast. Tell me about your culture and your society and this thing called Yiddish. Tell me about that.
Yiddish is the old Jewish language. There are two Jewish languages, or at least two. There's Hebrew, which is the liturgical, the religious language that is used in religious ceremonies. And then there's Yiddish, which is a language that grew up in Eastern Europe over many centuries and was used as the everyday language by Jews all over Europe up until World War II, up until the Holocaust.
Give me some more background concerning that. Is there, I know some people, I don't hear it that often, but there used to be a language in African-American culture called Pig Latin, and I don't hear too many people talk that way any longer. Is this language a language that is like within family? Is this a Morse code? What are some of the other aspects of this culture icon called Yiddish?
It was a public language. It's still spoken in the most Orthodox communities in Brooklyn, for example, but it mostly, people don't use it anymore for their day-to-day activities, but it used to be used in the marketplace, in the kitchens. It was even used in the religious schools to discuss the religious texts, and there's a literature. There's a big literature of Yiddish that flowered for about 150 years up through World War II, and it's the language that my ancestors used to speak. And when my mother died, I became interested in learning Yiddish as a kind of memorial to my mother. When my mother was alive, I could count on her to keep track of the past and of my ancestors. And then when she died, I thought, I'm going to study Yiddish to just keep in touch with the people who have gone before.
One other aspect before we go further. When I think about the Hebrew language, it's a very pictorial language, very colorful language. In adding Yiddish to my vocabulary, what other things is it? Is it a very more emotional? Is it? I'm still trying to get to know a little bit more of the nuances, because to me, for a person who's listening who doesn't understand your heart, okay, well, that was something that my ancestors had. Why would I spend the time, energy, and effort to pursue it? I'm still.
There's something about it, you know. There's something about going into a language and really immersing yourself into it. That just gives you such a precious feeling of connection to your past and to the people who came before. And to, I just think it's such a privilege to be able to inhabit the lives of people who aren't there anymore and to really feel a connection. And, of course, with the Holocaust, which wiped out a culture pretty much in the place where my ancestors came from, which is Lithuania, there's not a whole lot that you can go back and look at and see. And that's true of course, many other cultures. For example, slave culture, there's very little that you can actually put your finger on and go visit the actual places. You can't say, you know, that's where my great-great-great-grandfather lived. It's hard to do that. But this language is still there, the texts are still there, and you can still just enter that world through words. It's just a wonderful thing.
So tell me about your personal journey. Even before I go, I'm thinking, when we use the term Holocaust as it relates to the Jewish people, for some of us, it seems to be only localized to one area, maybe Germany, whatever the case may be. Were there various places where Holocaust took place? Remind us of that, and then give us the difference and similarities between this and your homeland.
Well, Hitler's Germany was where the Holocaust began, the annihilation of European Jews. But then Hitler invaded countries all over Europe. And in Lithuania, which is in the northern part of Europe, in a part of Europe called the Baltics, where there's Latvia and Estonia as well, the German army came in. There were these mobile killing squads that roamed through the countryside. And there was collaboration from the local Lithuanian, some people in the Lithuanian population, who agreed with Hitler's goal of wiping out, the actual goal was to get rid of every single Jew there. And so part of the 6 million Jews who were killed in what's called the Holocaust or the Shoah, the annihilation of the Jews, some of them, 220,000 Lithuanian Jews were among those who died. My own family, some of them were killed. People were actually just herded, rounded up in the city, in the cities, the towns and the villages, and taken out into the forests and machine gunned to death. And some of my relatives suffered that fate. I also had an uncle, my uncle Will, who survived the Holocaust in Lithuania in a ghetto. Many of the urban Jews were confined in these ghettos with barbed wire around them for a period of years. And when I decided to go back to Lithuania to sort of touch the past, I went to see my uncle Will, who I had known all my life. He had, after the war, he came and moved to New York City. And I went up to his apartment, and he and my aunt Manya were there. And I showed them some maps that I had downloaded from the Internet and said, "Where exactly did you live? Tell me exactly where to go." And he showed me that, but then he also took a little slip of paper out of his pocket, and he showed it to me, and he said, "Read this." And when I read this piece of paper, it revealed a secret about my uncle's behavior during the war that I was completely shocked by. And so as I went off to Lithuania to touch my past, I was very troubled by this story that I'd heard from my uncle about what he had done. It really shook up my view of basically of humanity. You know, I had thought of my uncle as one of the innocent victims, completely pure person, and then there were the completely bad people who did the killing, and then the also completely bad people who stood by and did nothing. But with this revelation from my uncle, all that was sort of shook up and tossed up in the air. And I began to open up to the possibility that, in fact, it's not so simple. It's not so black and white. And that feeling was compounded when I got a request from an old man in my ancestral town way up in the northeast corner of Lithuania. This was an old Gentile man, non-Jewish man, who as a young boy had witnessed the terrible things that were done to the Jews during World War II. And this knowledge had tormented him all his life, and he said he wanted to speak to a Jew before he died, and would I be that Jew? And I was quite hesitant because inside me was this sort of unconscious or unexamined sense of distance and alienation from another people, from Lithuanians. And I thought, oh, this man, why would I want to speak to a Lithuanian bystander who just stood there while my people were killed? But I did end up speaking with that man, and it was really, it opened me up in a new way, and I began to see that things are just not so simple. There are things that are simple. It's bad to kill another person. The Holocaust was a terrible thing. Hitler was awful. But today, those of us who did not actually live through those events, I think, can afford to reach out across cultural barriers and talk to each other and listen to these terrible truths of the past and ask ourselves hard questions. Ask ourselves, what would I have done if somebody came knocking on my door who was on the run from the Nazis? Would I let that person in? Maybe yes, maybe no.
Okay. What did your uncle share with you?
Well, I would really encourage people to read my book to find that out. I spent a long time wondering whether I should judge my uncle. And I went to Lithuania thinking I am going to decide whether he was a good guy or a bad guy. But by the time I had traveled through this moral terrain of the Lithuanian Jewish past, I was not so quick to judge, and I wasn't so quick to put people in columns of this one is the victim and that one is the bystander, this one is the collaborator and that one is the rescuer. People are a mix.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you're not going to tell us a story that the other man shared with you.
The other man, I was afraid that the other man was going to reveal some horrible thing, like I killed children or something like that. In fact, the other man was someone who, at the age of 17, had watched Jews being gathered in this area and then marched down the road into the forest to be shot. And he felt helpless at the time. He did try to help in certain ways. He drove his wagon past the ghetto gate, and he threw carrots over the fence to hungry people, and the guards threatened to kill him for that. And this man had also been through a lot of very painful things that had been done to him. But that's not what was really, really troubling him. What was troubling him was the trauma of having stood by while other people were being injured. And he had never gotten over that. And that was a real revelation to me, that the trauma of watching as other people are injured is really an important and very difficult thing to get over. And I think that one of the things that people like this man need was people to listen to him and to recognize his pain and his innate goodness, and to process with him how helpless he felt, the helplessness of the bystander. You know, a lot of people say that bystander is really the key to moral behavior, because in some ways the people who are actually carrying out the terrible misdeeds can be hard to reach, and the victims can, you know, maybe are powerless to do anything. But it's those people who are standing by and watching who have a lot of power in that situation. That's something we really need to look at. And one of the things that's happening in Lithuania, and that happened to me, is the whole concept of asking yourself these questions. Have I ever been in a situation where other people were doing things I thought were wrong, and yet I stood there and I didn't help? And why is that? And can we actually, encourage ourselves and each other to stand up rather than stand by when bad things are happening? Can we make it easier to stand up than it is to stand by? What are the social conditions that we can help create so that it's not up to each individual to think, am I going to, you know, put my head up and get my head blown off as an individual? But can we be sure that that conditions are such, that our society is such, that they actually encourage us to speak up?
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you sharing this powerful book, We Are Here. Give me the final thought. Make sure I have the takeaway, and then tell me how to get a copy of this book and to be a part of your world.
Well, the book is called We Are Here, Memories of the Lithuanian Holocaust by Ellen Cassidy. That's me. And you can get the book at through any online bookseller or at a local bookstore. People can visit my website, www.ellencassidy.com. And I'm really glad to be able to speak with you about what I think is really a universal tale, which is how we can use the past to build a better and more tolerant future full of mutual understanding and recognition.
Well, thank you so very much for sharing this personal story and scholarship. This will be featured at DrAlvin.com, the business of wisdom, where world leaders and thinkers like yourself do come to chat. This also will be featured at DrAlvin.com on Facebook. And you continue to have a remarkable and amazing day, okay?
Thank you so much, Alvin.